hit an end cap at some point, dude. Right? Like, and then I can turn the corner, maybe check out of the grocery store. No, infinite aisle.
Anytime you have a dream where you're doing something endlessly, it's pretty fucking terrifying, right? Except for, like, maybe falling. Maybe if you're falling and you fall endlessly, then it's, like, reassuring because you're like, well, I've been falling for, like, an hour and I haven't hit the ground yet, and it seems like it's just as far away, so... I live here now.
Maybe I'm doing it right. Last time I had a parachute when I did this, not this time.
I know, I'm just, feel the wind in my sails, man. I don't know why I have sails. I'm dreaming, who cares? I grew some sails and I'm falling carelessly to the ground.
You ever notice that in a dream when you need wings, you don't have them?
And then when you have them, you can't use them.
Like, when you have them, you're in a cave. You're like, well, these aren't going to come in any handy at all.
That's the worst Jerry Seinfeld joke I've ever heard.
Welcome to Name Redacted Podcast. I'm Alexander Fulmer.
I'm Chris Nielsen.
And with us this week is a new guest for everybody, Dan Kozu, correct?
Correct.
Oh, shit, you fucking nailed it. That's why I didn't say it. Dan's a Hard Times writer and a new novelist now. So how did you... Well, first of all, I need to back up.
Yeah, let's back up, Chris.
I need to back up to several weeks ago where we had a very unprofessional interaction with you where we all thought that we had responded to... you to get you booked on the show, and we hadn't. And all I've been thinking since then is like, and I don't know why I never had this thought before, but like, I was like, this guy writes for the Hard Times. He's going to create some vindictive ass headline about how a local podcast can't get its shit together. And it's all going to be my fault.
Oh, this is going well.
This is going real well.
This is going very well.
Oh, man.
I can't wait to get Dan back.
Yeah, I know. I'm really excited about this, too. Yeah. I was, like, ready to fucking roll into it.
I'm excited for Dan.
I saw Captain Marvel last night.
Oh, yeah?
I did. It was good. It's kind of gotten to a point now where it was good, but, like, after Infinity War, like, there's just, like, this next level now that you've got to, like, achieve with those movies.
I don't know if I agree with that, because, like, if everything is that level, then... Everything is just kind of...
No, and so I guess that's what I was going to say, is that it's kind of gotten to the point with Captain Marvel where it was like, it is good, it is acceptable, it is exactly what I wanted it to be, it didn't blow me away, but that's also okay because it fucking delivered. Like, it's been a long time now since they put out a movie where I went into it and I didn't feel like it delivered on the promise of what it was, you know?
Yeah, I mean, I'm looking
3 years. Civil War was the last time I really felt, like, let down walking out of it a little bit. And Civil War was still good.
Not
the best, but
I don't know. I don't have the most positive feelings towards Civil War.
Yeah. Well, and there's Skrulls now. Skrulls exist in the MCU, so that's pretty cool. It's an interesting interpretation of them. I do wish. I guess this is light spoiler territory, but I do wish the movie had been a little Skrullier. Because they kind of leaned fairly heavily on that in the marketing.
Is the timeline of this before Infinity
War? It's in the 90s. Yeah, so it's about the Skrull-Kree War, and it takes place in the 90s. Yeah, so you get to see... They de-aged Nick Fury fantastically. He looks amazing, and he doesn't have the eye patch.
Cool. You know...
He's got hair.
Samuel L. Jackson doesn't age anyway, so they could have just used Samuel L. Jackson.
Well, that's what Taylor is saying, too. And I mean, they did. It was Samuel L. Jackson, but they just...
But, I mean, they could have, like, not even... Like, not even negative aged him.
I mean, he's definitely older now than he was in Iron Man.
I mean, but, like, still, you can barely tell the difference between...
Well, they pretty much just gave him hair and tightened up his cheeks, and that was pretty much it. But it looks good.
Yeah, they're tight cheeks.
Coulson's in it, and they de-aged Coulson a little bit, too. But, again, he doesn't really look a whole lot older either.
Coulson-y. I don't know, like, the Marvel movies and stuff, like, at a certain point in time, like, when you think about the speed and the, you know, sheer amount, number, whatever you want to call it, like, of these movies that we're getting all the time, like, the saturation point is fucking, like, yeah. Yes. Like, I, dude, you know what?
But it's good. I mean, they're consistently good, though. And, I mean, that's the thing, I don't think it makes them bad at all because they put out so many good movies, but it definitely does make it a little bit more, less spectacular, I guess, you know, because you go in and you're like, this is going to be a good movie. Man, it is a good movie. You're like, well, I'm happy. I spent $12 today.
That's the thing, right? Is that, like, at what point in time is he back?
Am I back? Can you hear me?
Yeah! Dan, please take this nightmarish train wreck away from us and talk about yourself.
Well, I saw Captain Marvel yesterday. Is that what we're talking about? Is that what you wanted to hear?
What we're talking about.
Okay, yes.
I'm in the dark. Let's go. Thoughts on Captain?
Yeah, what was your?
I was fine. I kind of walked out like, yeah, it was a movie, and I was entertained. It wasn't my favorite of the recent movies, but yeah. It was fine.
That is exactly what the sentiment we've been vamping on since we spoke to you 10 minutes ago.
is that Marvel movies, for the most part, are in fact movies.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not mad about spending money on them.
And I'm not that upset about it. Like, it's okay with me that not every single one of their movies is, you know, fucking the original Avengers, which was so good.
Yeah.
And,
right, yeah. It was the first one, the Marvel that I saw felt like it was borrowing from DC. Like, I felt they borrowed a lot from what DC did with Wonder Woman,
yeah.
Which is weird because DC seems to always borrow from Marvel. It was the first one I saw where I was like, it seems like they're actually borrowing a little DC now.
Yeah, well, they're starting to get to the point where, like, Captain Marvel is more of that traditional, like, it's that DC-type superhero. She can fly, she's got, you know, they're starting to kind of, they're moving into the cosmic territory, and so that's giving them more of those, like, godlike superhumans and stuff like that. And
just waiting for Vulcan to appear.
Yeah.
Fuck everybody's day up. Who's that guy? Oh, this is going to be bad. Do you read comics? Strap in.
I felt so bad for the people sitting next to us, man. I was like, oh, yeah, because, like, the fucking thing from the comics, and this is how it played out there, and this is the, but that's not. And the dude, he's just, like, this old guy, and he's just, like, staring me down. And we were late. We came in, like, almost at the end of the previews, and I know that dude thought he got lucky and had an empty seat next to him, and then me and Taylor just came in and talked his fucking ear off for 2 hours.
Dude, I like to sit through movies and try as hard as I can not to say much. But there are points in time where, like, my overly zealous nerd bone just takes control.
Just can't control.
and brain communicates with mouth. Go ahead, man. Just say it. Just say what you're thinking. And mouth goes, that's not right.
See, that's the nice thing is I've been married for 11 years, so I can just shoot my wife a glance, and she knows, like, what I'm trying to say with just a look, and that's why we can nail it during the movie.
Yeah.
I became that woman who's like, don't go in there. They're in there with an axe. Don't walk around that corner. Like, I became that woman for a minute, and then all of a sudden, everyone turned and looked at me, and I was like, I'm sorry. I don't mean to. But
oh, man. So we've got Dan on because you just finished up a novel that you're about to release. And you've been writing for one of my favorite blogs, The Hard Times. And for anybody unaware, it's kind of like the punk rock Onion. So
yeah,
how did you get started up? Is that where you started writing, or how did you kind of come into being a writer?
No, I went to film school. So actually I am a screenwriter by trade. And then just didn't enjoy the filmmaking process and but kept writing. And then I wrote, like, kind of sad bastard stuff when I was in, like, angry college art student screenplays and just,
sure.
And then really just, I think working for The Hard Times, I just sharpened my comedy sword. And
yeah.
I realized that's kind of where I wanted to go and
sure.
Never really said something I could do, but it's, and I'm actually really enjoying it.
So how do you get started doing that? Do they do like submissions and stuff or do they actually have a team of writers?
It's actually, I'm trying to, I'm just like, can I talk out of school? But they don't care. It's a private it's like a Facebook group, and there's actually like 300 writers.
Yeah.
Probably only 50 or so consistently submit.
Okay.
And so actually a friend of mine sent me a Hard Times article when I was like in a job that I hated, and I'm like, and so I looked into seeing how to submit for them, and you send like 10 article headlines, and then what I later find out is they put it to all of the writers, and if all of the writers say that like these are kind of good, then they add you to the Facebook group.
Okay.
And then in this private Facebook group, you pitch headlines. And so it's actually up to all the freelancers to decide what articles move forward. And so it's the same as like likes and loves and laugh emojis. And then the ones that get like 10 or more move on to the editors.
Okay.
And the editors decide if they're gonna run them or not.
Yeah. Huh.
I feel like I'd be good at that.
So it's actually a very democratic system. And it's wonderful because it's not everybody fighting to get articles. It's really, we really all go after it, like for the love of the Hard Times. And so we support one another, and we help one another's jokes. We don't like not like other people's stuff, so our own stuff gets through, and those people kind of get weeded out very quickly.
Yeah. So did you come up in like the independent, like underground kind of scene?
In what way?
Well, just because...
did you listen to Black Flag?
Yeah.
Just fucking say it, Chris. Say what you're thinking.
I'm going to ask everybody that now, from now on.
I didn't know if you meant like independent comedy or independent music or independent... I can't play a lick of music. I was actually more... punk and ska in high school. And then for some reason, when like new metal came out, I'm like, fuck new metal. And I like punk because it was more like... legit, apparently.
Yeah.
But now I just love music now. But yeah. So I would say yeah. I also kind of grew up in a weird Christian household, so I like Christian punk for a lot.
Okay. Oh, dude. Me too. I feel you. Yeah, yeah. Fucking Dogwood and MXPX man. I'm there. I'm there.
So
Calibretto. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So many punk kids grew up with that. Like, oh no, like I went to church a shit ton, and then I was like, I don't know, Henry Rollins is rad.
I don't know if it's a liberal thing, but when you're like in a weird conservative house, that's your only like you see this weird other like land that's punk, but your parents let you listen to it because it's Christian punk. And and then you just fall down the rabbit hole.
Well, that's the weird thing about some of the Christian punks too, stuff, because like Calibretto
these guys are talking about Jesus, but they're wearing leather jackets and they got liberty
flags. So like for instance, like Calibretto is like very critical of like the modern church, but they're like or at the time were like devout Christians, and so it's like this weird like they're being punk about their religion, and that's not something you get in religion, you know. But I digress.
Like 90s Christian punk now, they're either all atheists, or you know that when they were in Christian punk, they were just shitty punk, and they knew they could be bigger in the Christian.
Yeah, 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 yeah.
Yeah, I know about Norma Jean.
Yeah, 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 yeah. Or they're Reliant K, and they just play pop music.
Oh, fuck it. I remember, like, somebody was like, listen to Sadie Hawkins dance, and I listened to it, and I was like, this is, like, super upbeat. And then they were like, yeah, that's Christian punk. And I was like, no, it isn't.
I don't want any more Bad Blink. What do you...
This is music that a person made that a lot of Christian kids like, and they were like, we're Christian!
Yeah,
that's what this is.
Fucking kudos, first and foremost, because we get a decent amount of submissions on the show, and I am oftentimes sent a piece of media that somebody is requesting to come onto the show to talk about, and I crack open the first page or press play.
They don't all make it.
And I do not always make it to the end of it, first of all, and I oftentimes do not enjoy it. And what you have done with Lingeria is fantastic, man. I honestly am very happy that we had the opportunity to meet you to read the book.
Wow, thank you.
Yeah, I don't know if you got your rehearsed spiel or something, if you want to kind of talk about...
This is, like, the first interview I've ever done in my life, so I'm sorry.
No shit? Okay.
Safe space.
But, yeah, this was a pilot that I actually wrote for a cartoon, and then it didn't make any sense, because it's about... I call it Lingeria, but I actually make the joke that nobody knows how to pronounce it.
Right, yeah.
It's based off of a book, and so... But it's about an author, sort of a Tolkien-esque author who has a very famous line of fantasy novels. And at the beginning of the book, he's attempting to kill himself. And he accidentally or somehow finds a portal in his oven that he's trying to suffocate himself in into Lingeria. And it turns out that the world of Lingeria that he goes into has copies of his book and revere them as the Bible. And he is what they call the author, which is technically God. And so he is worshipped in this world, and there's paintings of him everywhere. And it's all about how, him coming into this and meeting the characters that he created. But there's also a wizard that has taken over the world, and he hates wizards, and he's never written about a wizard, so he doesn't know how this wizard got there. And so that's basically what the book is about, is him wandering around this world that he created.
I used the term, I was talking to Gavin. Gavin's like, well, what's the book about? And I was like, well, George R.R. Martin fucking Freddy knew nightmares himself. And he's like, oh, okay. Got it. Cool. Cool. I'm in.
I'm stealing that.
You can have it. So what was, I assume based on, because it is satirical of the fantasy genre, I assume that that's something that you have some experience with that you're a fan of going into it.
Yeah, I love fantasy. I kind of have an ADD problem, so I have a hard time reading giant, bulky novels.
Right.
Yeah, I do love fantasy very much. I love the Wizard of Oz books.
Okay.
And if you read the later ones, L. Frank Baum starts them, like, he talks about himself at the beginning of them and how he actually exists. And he always... You could see him getting so sick of writing about Oz in the later books. Like, he'll end a book and making, and Oz turn invisible and we can never talk to them again. The next book will start like, oh, God damn, I found a radio and I can talk to Dorothy. Like, you can stop making me write these books. And that's really where I came from, was how sick of Oz he was.
Yeah.
And that's what, and in Lingeria, the author, Norman, it's the fame that he got from, he wants to write about anything other than the world, and he hates his characters, and he's also a drunk, and he's just clinically depressed, and he's kind of cut everybody out of his life, so he has other problems going on.
It's so hard, because, like, I want to talk about it, but I don't want to ruin it for anybody, because it's not out yet.
If I'm being totally honest.
About April 1st, so.
Yeah, I did not get a chance to get through it. Because of my schedule, so I'm actually very much looking forward to it, because I don't have a whole lot of books that I read, which is why I usually do audiobooks.
Yeah.
But, like, I want to read this.
Yeah. Well, it's good. So one of the things I also really appreciated about the book is that you get into, because it has that real-world connection, you get a chance to talk about things like what a fan's relation is to an art form and how much control the author maintains over their art versus how much a fan has. And I don't know, like, that was a really, really cool way to do that, I guess, like, with that fantasy backdrop and being able to do something that is like almost social satire in a way, but still kind of fits in the confines and talks about the subject matter of it. I don't know. I guess what made you have the thought that this was the story that you wanted to commit to putting down 300 pages of?
It just kept coming out, I think. And I was able to break it up, because normally, like, that's another thing with my attention span is that's why I love writing screenplays, because you can kind of just do a scene description and then you can kind of push and push and push and just kind of keep going.
Yeah.
And this, I was able to kind of chunk it up, the chapters and the events were able to kind of come out. There's a through line, obviously, but it kind of have a, it's event after event after event.
Right. So it's very episodic in fantasy fashion.
Episodic, yeah. Thank you. Yeah. Yeah. And so I just kind of attacked it that way. And yeah, that's really how I felt like. I didn't really go into it being like, I'm going to attack fanboys. Like, but we're also in that culture now. And like, while I was writing it, all of this stuff with like gamers and Gamergate and all this other stuff started coming out. And I think I didn't intentionally mean to do that, but it just kind of came out. That's where my mind was at the time. So,
well, and I think it's really sincere, because I don't, to me, it didn't read as though you were like attacking the neckbeard as a person. It did feel like you were attacking the neckbeard as a stereotype, you know. And I think that through exploring the motivations of what makes that type of person do the things that they choose to do, it also helped illustrate some of the weaknesses in the creators too, and especially in a landscape where we've seen things change to where creators are now expected to be more public entities. You know, like if you're a novelist, if you're a writer, traditionally you're behind a keyboard and you're just typing away in your own safe space, and you don't have to interact with people until, you know, you're getting signing books, you know. But that's not the world we live in anymore. Now people expect you to have a Patreon and be, you know, up with stuff and communicative and build a community, and I think that's an interesting thing too, just seeing how Norman is very old guard in that sense and doesn't necessarily understand what a modern fandom is to some extent too.
Yeah, and I think there's a portion where his books are being turned into a movie, and he doesn't particularly want that, but he's taking the paycheck for it. And I think that's sort of another part of the old guard, is you're not a successful author unless you have a successful movie based off your books, which is kind of a weird thing. And so that's kind of where he doesn't like that, but he doesn't want people touching his creation, but he hates his creation anyway. So
yeah,
and that's what he struggles with through the whole book is, does he actually like what he created?
Yeah. So making the book meta as it is, where it's a book about a book that exists, how much of the meta series did you actually have to figure out in your head, or were you just kind of flying by, like, well, this is my story and I'm going to make the book inside of the book kind of cater to the story that as it fits in the actual book that I'm writing?
The author answer is, of course, I planned it out completely.
But
the
yeah.
I completely made it up as I went along, but I went back because it was actually, I start each chapter now with a quote from the books that don't really exist. And I actually did that probably after I was finished with the book. I didn't.
Okay. So, which ties together well in the end too. It's a nice established bit too.
I kind of built the world as I went along, and I did kind of shoehorn it in so it fit into the themes that I was going for in the book that I was writing. And so there isn't like, so I do have sort of pages and pages of notes, but I built it the way I needed to build it, not the other way around.
Right.
I mean, that's kind of the way you have to do it, right? Like, cause if it's not a real thing, like, you're not going to write five fucking books just to write a book you're going to release. I wrote these five books that no one else is going to read. They're for me, for my references, so I can make this other book for you assholes to read, not knowing that I actually wrote six books. That's a little too much, I think. Now, I think it is interesting, like, because the process you're going through and everything, especially talking about, you know, the author's point of view on his book, because it's actually funny, because my favorite author right now seems to be kind of going through that with a thing, because it's been so long since he released a new chapter in his most famous series, and he's just cranked through a few other series in between and, like, has started a couple more. And apparently now every time somebody asks him about when the new book's coming out, he just gets fucking angry. He just gets, like, really upset because he's just like, I'm fucking working on it. I gave you all these other fucking books, and, like, they're turning things into TV shows. Just be grateful, you fucking idiots. Like, that's kind of how it feels. And, like, just the idea of that being a caricature.
Right.
That's the main through line of a whole story. Mm-hmm. That sounds so enjoyable to see somebody else's frustration play out in a thing of their own.
And it's great because that's such, at least as a creator, like, that's so relatable, right? Because, I mean, just think about how many projects we've got going on at any given point in time. And we're like, okay, well, you know, we're doing this thing over here, we're doing that over there. You know, part of the reason that I like to have multiple projects is because I'm very ADD and I want to be able to work on multiple things at once, you know? But given a world where one thing just is a runaway hit and doesn't allow for me to continue to work on some of those other things, I'm not going to say that I might not be spiteful too. I mean, you know, there's a certain amount of enjoyment that you get from being able to diversify in a creative output that you get from, you know, this is a part of me. I've now expressed myself through that, and I need to express a different part of myself somewhere else for that cathartic release that I get from creating art.
It's that curse of popularity, man. Like, once you're doing a thing that people like, it kind of comes out of your hands, and it's, in a lot of ways, it's not about you anymore. It's not about what you want. It's about the fact that you created the thing that a bunch of other people like. It's kind of like the way that people feel about Star Wars, right? Like, at the end of the day, it's fucking George Lucas's thing. Like, he can do whatever the fuck he wants with it because he created it, but he knows every time he does a thing, there are going to be millions of people out there that are going to be like, no, you did it wrong.
Right. Yeah. Right. So, and that's why you make Howard the Duck.
And that's where you make Howard the fucking Duck. Chris, we cracked the code.
I understand now. I get it, guys.
So,
case closed.
6 years of doing this podcast. Guys, welcome to my real estate podcast.
It's got a talking duck. Yeah. Me and my co-host, Affleck.
This is me petting a duck. Sorry.
This is your first piece of long-form work?
Yeah, of prose, yeah, long-form prose, yeah.
Okay.
I'm sorry.
Oh, I was going to say, how was it similar to what you expected, or how was it different from what you expected it to be?
It was different because you really have to you have to explain everything, but I actually don't I don't like answering all the questions. I like letting the reader's imagination kind of build part of the world, and so I tried not to over-describe everything, which is my excuse for why it might be not over-described at times.
Yeah.
But I think that's where I actually had to go through and be like, no, like, a director's not going to fill this part in. Like,
yeah,
this isn't for an actor to interpret. This is for me to interpret for the reader.
Yeah.
Let the reader interpret it how they want. And, and that's like, cause I had an editor, and the editor's like, oh, you should really you should explain this part. And I'm like, no, I'm going to let the reader figure that out if they want to. Yeah, I think that was the biggest challenge, was deciding what I wanted to show and what I wanted to hide.
Yeah. Okay. Interesting. It's got to be interesting working with an editor on a creative project, or like on prose like that, when you're not as used to doing something, you know, like, it sounds like the writing prior to that, it's a different kind of editorial process. It's closer to like a journalistic editorial process almost.
Yeah, I didn't have a whole lot, because, like, Hard Times edits, but it's theirs, so it's their, like, I what I like part of it is that I release it to them, and they can change, they add jokes, they punch it up however they want.
If this,
and that's theirs. It's like, my name might be on it, but I really look at it as their face is on it, so they can do whatever they want with it. But this one, I really had to, with the editor, I really had to go through and kind of pick and choose, because I really wanted to listen, because this is my first long-form prose, and so I really had to listen to somebody who knew what they were talking about, but at the same time I had to sort of say, no, this is what I want to do. And I felt like a lot of the time they were saying, like, I make a Glenn Danzig reference at one point, and they're like, well, not everybody knows who that is, and I'm like,
who cares?
And this book's not for them.
And if they don't, like, if it's a 13-year-old and they go and look up Glenn Danzig and get into Danzig, like, good. Like, if they get into
Exactly. Like,
you
watch Family Guy. Do you know? Yeah.
Have you ever seen Venture Brothers? Nobody understands any of those jokes.
Exactly.
That's the point. Those are all deep cuts, motherfucker.
The culture that I discovered by references when I was a kid, that's what I had to go through, was figuring out what I wanted to keep and what I felt that, yeah, you're right. Like, we really need to cut that, or I really need to explain that better. And listening.
So, Trey in the chat wants to know, how many ritual sacrifices were performed during the creation of this all words, no picture, leather bound storybook?
Okay. He has to be specific. How many human sacrifices?
I think just ritual. I don't know.
Ritual.
Take that as
ritual
you will.
Ritual sacrifices.
Five animals died. Not all were sacrifices, but five.
One of them I just hit with my car on the way home. I wasn't paying attention.
There are two pictures. I do have somebody doing cover art for the book, an illustrator named Rocky Negron, who's really good. I actually did my own map, which was insane, but it's just a silly little thing. So there are two pictures, Trey.
Yeah, true. Because he asked in the fucking chat. He was like, are there pictures? I was like, I don't think so. He goes, nah, I'm good. But fucking, like, so have you pitched this to a publisher? Is this is being published by an actual publisher, or are you doing this on your own?
Okay, well, here's the thing. I got picked up by a publisher, and mm-hmm. then I got really self-righteous, and I left. And
okay. Now I'm punk rock.
Oh, hey!
Punk rock.
Somebody else in this room has done that, too!
Yeah, I think all of us have had some variation on that.
Yeah.
I had a cartoon picked up a long time ago that I was doing with a couple guys, and the same thing sort of happened, but we signed with a production company, and we just... I mean, it was what you think. Like, they were just all, like, awful. They had all these, like, every change. Like, it wasn't ours anymore. And so we walked away, and we did our own, and it still kind of sucks. But I just really was kind of proud that I felt that I could do that. And
yeah.
This time they were being really weird with ownership and IP stuff. And I'm like, no, I've been a paralegal for almost 20 years. I'll continue being a paralegal and not yeah. sell as many books. Like, that's fine.
Yeah.
Also, I know how legal shit works. I'm a paralegal.
That's pretty good to have in your back pocket.
That's true. And I sent them like an edited contract, and they're like, "Oh, we don't allow edits."
What? This also sounds familiar.
It just got weirder and weirder, and I
yeah.
But I have total control over it now. So
yeah,
Dan, me and you are gonna have a conversation later. About how me and you went in to basically the exact same situation, and now
it's a rough one. Well, and especially with a book like that, where it is, I don't know, like the traditional publishing structure in satire is just such a hard thing to rectify to some extent too, because yeah. like you're trying to say something, and then by having an established, you know, entity that is trying to tell you what you can say because of accessibility reasons, and I don't know, and that. I don't know. Yeah, it just seems so mushy.
Yeah,
it is. A niche market, and I was looking up who else writes satire fantasy, which is a very small market.
Yeah,
that's like my favorite author, fucking thing. I'm not even kidding.
Who isn't last name Pratchett? like two suburbs north of me, which is insane that in the entire United States, this guy lives just really close to me.
You guys could have an industry convention in your living room.
Yeah.
And so it's amazing. Like, he's been amazing, and he kind of talked me through it when I felt like I was going to move on. Like, he self-publishes as well, and
yeah.
But he's been amazing to kind of help me, like when I need somebody to talk to about the business. So
yeah.
So you do qualify your work as satirical fantasy. That's yeah. the realm. Okay.
It's close to parody, but I wouldn't call it parody. I think it's more satire.
I personally am like I'm actually even now more excited to yeah. read the book.
Well, because the joke is not the fantasy world the way that parody would be. You know, like Spaceballs, the joke is, hey, it's Star Wars. This is goofy.
The joke is right. is what the writer is going through
right.
is fucking nonsense.
Yeah.
So I like I said, this makes me more excited to read the book because my favorite version of literature, like I actually I went to school for English lit, and my concentrations were creative writing and rhetoric, and satire satire is my thing. Like I can't describe. I think it's the most elegant and hardest version of literature to do effectively and to do correctly. And like, you know, some of the things that have been put out in satire have been just so well thought out and amazing. And I love fantasy, so. The fact that you are doing a satirical fantasy thing is like, it's like the thing that was built for me to read it.
Yeah, I was gonna say it's perfect that you reached out to the show because satirical fantasy with dick jokes is absolutely like in our fucking in a real house.
It's literally the thing we do.
Oh, you fucking stuck out of the park on that.
It's a modest proposal with wizards. Is what it is. Like, sorry, A Modest Proposal is my favorite piece of literature. I just think it's fucking, it's brilliant. Like, I love it. But
I'm not
I do, I love
that.
It.
I looked that one up.
Yeah, it's, It's a dude who...
You didn't take English class in high school?
Modest Proposal is a guy who is proposing a way to end the Irish famine by basically eating babies. It's really funny. It's fucking super funny. But yeah, like, satire is hard, man. Like, there are a lot of people that try to do it and just fucking fail and either end up in parody or just making something that just essentially just looks... just looks very fucking hateful instead of being, you know, effective. And I think that that's a hard line to tote, right? Like, that line between seeming just aggressive and fucking, like, basically just very confrontational for no reason versus, like, pointing out a thing that is, you know, something that is thoughtful and thought-provoking without beating it to death.
Yeah.
So, you know, and so kudos to you for being able to even fucking get through it, because I know a lot of people that would have not, like, just been like, no, this is a lot. So, and 300 pages.
And I started, because there's especially in the hard times, there's people who are like, I don't like this part of punk rock. Like, I don't like how women are treated in the pit or something like that. And they can make a great joke that way. They're like, that's how their in is.
Yeah.
And like, and we talk about this like it, like when we're doing pitches or whatever. And then, but I always start with the joke. Like, that's my in. I can't sit down and be like, today I'm going to think about like nerd culture and Star Wars. Like, I can't. This is not. I need the joke first, and then I kind of find the
truth
aspect of culture around it. Yeah. And that's just, I mean, but every writer writes differently, obviously. So that's how I find it. And I, working for the hard times, really, again, that's how I kind of figured this all out, was because when you can pitch into a room and not have to kind of worry about it, and like, you don't have to pitch so many times. Like, they don't care if you disappear for 2 weeks, if you have a hard time or something. Like, it's not like the,
it's
onion
the hard times
where,
yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. They're used to hard times.
So you've decided to self-publish the book. I'm sure that you've got to be pretty nervous about doing that and not having like a distribution lined up, or like how are you feeling about the path you have ahead of you?
My only goal is to be able to pay for another book.
Okay.
That's really kind of all. I don't expect to quit my job. Like, I mean, that's not where I'm at. I just want to make enough to where I don't have to go out of pocket to publish my next one.
Yeah.
And so I think I'm gonna do some cons and sell at the table, which I hear doesn't sell very well, but people start to learn. Like, you meet a lot of people that way, and then sell online.
Mm-hmm. Literally, our business plan.
Exactly.
Yeah. Well, that's good, and that's also a good way to like do networking too, and try to find yourself in a better position if you do want to go a more traditional route. Because then you're kind of building those connections, and you get to talk to people that have had other situations where it's like, hey, man, yeah, I know that publisher. Maybe kind of not sure about that, but like, hey, have you talked to these guys? Like, I can kind of hook you up over here, and you know, maybe this is gonna be a better fit for you too.
Right. Yeah.
And yeah.
From what I hear, a lot of the smaller publishers don't really help you in your PR anyway. Like, they pay for your editing and your book cover and everything, but it's still up to you to promote it.
Yeah,
They might pay like, or they might get you into places, but
how much does that really help in 2019? Really, yeah,
fucking exactly, flashbacks, dude.
Yeah, you're gonna give Alex a heart attack.
Oh tonight, my god, I smell toast. I'm fucking having a stroke. This is constant flashbacks. Sorry, I gotta stop. Damn. Tell us more.
You like that question? That's the best question.
You already went through this. I'm going through this now. This is my
nom. Fucking.
You're faring better than him so far.
Yeah, it's like we're in the stage that you were in probably 6 months ago. We pitched to a place. It was a top publisher for comic books. We got picked up in the room without showing them shit. Like, we gave them the elevator pitch. We gave them one picture that was colored that didn't have anything to do with the book, and they were like, cool, we'll sign it. Dope, awesome. This is too good to be true. You're right. It is, Alex. It is too good to be true. We went through it, and like, we proposed pitches or edits to them about the contract in the beginning, and I was basically told, like, you're probably not going to get any of this. And I was like, all right, that's fine. So then it was coming up towards deadline, and I was like, you know, like, you guys haven't been real communicative about stuff, and, like, we're not real on top of, like, we've never had to do this full out before, and it'd be nice to get a little bit more insight and stuff. And then I had a lawyer look over it, and he was like, eh, this is pretty loophole-y, man. Like, there's some problems with this. And I was like, all right. So essentially what it boiled down to was me going, look, we're not comfortable with the contract. I think we want to pull out. And then I got a response from him that made me really kind of pissed off, which was, well, do you need us to edit anything in the contract? Fuck. Are you fucking serious? Like, I fucking sent you 6 edits, and they were all reasonable as shit. Like, they weren't even insane. I didn't ask you for money. And you told me no, so no. Like, I don't want to fucking edit the contract. And so, essentially, we were just like, look, we're just going to fucking pull out of this. Because we know that the material is good, the art is good, the color is good, everything's good. We're going to regroup. Everybody got super busy for a while. We're now going back to the drawing table. We got an offer from a top 10 to give them a fucking pitch. And we were like, all right, let's work on the pitch. And now we're, if this top 10 and the other 2 places we're submitting it, don't go ahead and give us something that's worth our time, we're just going to self-publish. Like, right. we're going to put it on fucking... we're going to change the format a little bit, and we're going to put it up on fucking one of the streaming comic sites where we have to do like 5 pages a week or something, and we're going to restructure That's it a smart. Little bit, and then we're going to take that and use like Patreon and some other stuff to get a print version, and then once it's like fully combined yeah. into like a volume, we'll pitch it again to a place and see if right. they want to pick up the rights.
Yeah.
So, you know, where you're at is familiar for me, and like I know it's tough, and it's a fucking struggle. But I think that, you know, the way that you're doing it is the correct way to do it. You have a thing that you're passionate about, that you like, that you have, you know, confidence in, and it just needs to be out. And like,
right.
You care about it,
and,
clearly.
And with a novel specifically, it's a lot easier too, because like, you know, with the comic book, you finish part of that first issue, you write out the first issue, you submit it, and then once you get picked up, it's serialized, so you continue to come out too. But when you've got a novel, you're in the situation where you're like, you have a thing that's finished.
Yeah.
And now you can put it out and be like, okay, whatever, it's done. I mean, nothing that happens now is going to change how finished this book is.
So you know, your next book that you want to fund, is that like do you want to do the like a series? Do you want to do something new?
I have an idea for a sequel to this one, but I actually think I'm going to do a different.
Cool.
The whole point was not getting sick of
Yeah.
the theme of my book. So I do have a second one, but I don't think that's going to be the next one I'm going to write. I've started one already that I'm moving ahead with. So that's probably going to be the next one I do.
Okay. Cool. Fantasy stuff still, or are you changing it up some?
This will be probably more in the realms of like the Jim Butcher, but it's still humorous.
Yeah.
Alex just like praise Jesus for a second there.
Guess who's real mad about Dresden Files and is getting really pissed off about people asking about the next one? It's Jim fucking Butcher. Way to nail it, motherfucker. Dan, on my brainstem. We're buds now. Me and Dan are pros. See you at the con, buddy.
Where are you guys, North Carolina? I can get up there.
Actually, so here, fun fact. We're actually in High Point, North Carolina. So as you know in your book, it is, we are... oh, yeah.
legitimately so, part of your book, apparently.
So it's just outside of Greensboro.
Yeah.
Okay. I got family in Chapel Hill.
Oh, okay, yeah, just an hour down the road. But so the whole time I was reading the epilogue, or read the last chapter of the epilogue of the book, and they're like on their way home to High Point, and I was like, yes, we're going home. That's where I live. High Point. I don't know why you didn't put a space in it. That's weird, but I don't even care because I do that sometimes too. There's a hell of a lot less heroin in that High Point.
Guys, you know that thing where like a thing feels too personal? That's it. That's the one. But yeah, so how long did it take you to make the book, man?
Probably a year. Like when I really sat down and said like, this is it, I'm gonna do it. It was a year. Mostly,
years fast.
At my day job, I did a lot of it because that's real. Because that's really when you're forced to sit at a desk.
And, yeah,
and
absolutely.
Have like, I was kind of in a comfortable zone. Nothing was really changing. So I was able to kind of be on autopilot.
Yeah.
And then, so I would work on the structure at home, and I kind of had a notebook where I would say, okay, this plot point. And then when I got to work, I already knew where I was going structurally. So I was able to just kind of let the words kind of do it and have fun with it.
Nice. That's always I always say, don't quit your day job. Make your day job quit you. Because you're just so focused on it.
Dude, this is the first job that I've had that's not active, right? Like the real estate thing.
Where you get like downtime.
Yeah, like the real estate thing, I do when I have time to do it. But the day job thing that I have, like I sit at a desk all day, but it's making fucking phone calls, and I sit right next to one of the manager's offices.
Yeah.
So I can't just be like... like, because they'll be like, I don't hear fucking phones clicking there, bitch.
Your day job will quit you real quick.
Yeah, my day job would be like, Alex, we just don't need you because you don't do anything. And I'd be like, you're right.
We actually moved from one floor where I had a beautiful, like, looking out, like, north into the mountains where, like, the... and then they moved us, and I was literally put in a corner... Like Milton in Office Space, like in a corner. All the other offices are unoccupied, and I'm just like, okay, well, I'm gonna write a book. Like, you're gonna screw me this way. Like, I'm gonna, like, and I still have the job, so I didn't screw it over. But
you know,
but
Dan,
yeah, I was just like,
you've already gotten paid to write this book.
Damn, you're right.
There we go. That's the good stuff. So they moved you into a corner in that, and you were like, all right, like, now is the time where I do the thing I want to do.
Yeah, exactly. And I was still writing kind of screenplays and things like that, but this was I really had to concentrate, and this was staring at a beige wall for 8 hours. Like, I had nothing else, so that's exactly what I did, and that's how I was able to kind of do it. And I do have to think, like, my wife is the one who said, you can do this. Like, I really didn't believe I had the capacity, not even like the talent to write good book, but to actually write 300 pages.
Yeah.
That's
got to feel like an accomplishment to get to the end of that and be like, okay, I've made it through the marathon. Yeah. I mean, I got to edit it still, but like, I wrote Finn, it's over.
Like even
I'm
if
going
it's,
to sleep,
exactly, yeah,
even 100%. If it's garbage, I finished a thing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
This is more and than like, I can say for life.
I like my wife would read the screenplays that I wrote usually, and she'd be like, you write the scene descriptions really well and nobody will ever get to read them. Like the directors will, like, or whatever. But she's like,
yeah, some nerds in a film class.
Yeah,
exactly. And so she's like, you should really try and sit down and do something. And so that's pretty much what I did, was because she really kind of encouraged me to. So
hell yeah.
I'm going to start reading it when I get home.
Yeah, it's good. Yeah. It's very good. Trey coming in with the hot questions. How did the death of Betty White during your writing affect the overall tone and story arc of All Words, No Picture, Leather-Bound Storybook?
That question was like 20 minutes.
I closed myself off for about a month. Like, I was gone. I just turned on Lifetime, where they play it on a loop, just watching videos for 8 hours a day. Ate a cheesecake every hour on the
You are in really, really great shape for that. I gotta say, you maintained your figure well. Your metabolism is impressive, Dan.
All those typewriter calories, man. Getting it out. Heated. Lean it in.
Dan's
slaving over cigarettes.
Dan's fingers are so strong.
You don't see me from the chest down, though. I 400 pounds. I just ooze.
Two whole cheesecakes.
But yeah, man, like that is like, it's very impressive, especially like, did you feel that the time frame of a year, like when you got done with 300 pages in a year, did it feel fast? Did it feel slow? Like, how did that kind of feel?
I have an awful memory to begin with, but I don't like, if like an elf came to me and was like, hey, I actually wrote that, I'd be like, oh, that's where it all came from. Me writing, I'll read it and be like, oh, I remember, but I don't, like, the time passing, I don't remember that. Like,
yeah,
it's just it, and probably because I was bored out of my mind at work for like,
yeah. So that's actually an interesting question. I was gonna say, that's an interesting question. I should have thought of immediately. Is it autobiographical at all? Did you impart any of your personality into the characters in the book?
Every one of them, I think, I you have to put. to, you have to, you, I feel every character you have to like, even a villain. And so I put, there's a little bit of myself in every single character because I, that's how you can get an audience to relate to them. And so, but Norman, like, definitely, like his procrastination and his, I mean, I have anxiety issues. He has anxiety issues like that. I mean, that's, an, and then that's actually, I was going through a very bad portion of anxiety right before, and I was kind of coming out of it finally.
Mm-hmm.
And that's, and I was finally motivated to create again. And so that was sort of his journey of being motivated to live again was sort of my journey of being motivated to create again. I wasn't where he was, but I,
right.
But even like,
but it was rough.
I can't, yeah, I don't want to go too much in, into who the villain is and stuff like that, but there's right. a whole sort of theme of like fanboys and things like that. I mean, that's where I am too, is kind of dealing with getting mad at Lucas. Like, no, it's his creation. Like things that you said, like, and so, yeah, it was sort of me being a fan of things as well. And then letting people create and letting people make a mistake if they do. And
so was the writing of the book kind of, was it like cathartic in a way for you since all the shit went on?
Yeah, I think so. I think it was kind of. Yeah, I would say I have nothing else to add to that.
Like literally reading my thoughts.
Yeah, I mean, and like I said, man, like everything that you've been talking about with this, like it's clear that you care about what you're doing, that you're passionate about it, that like. The characters are important to you. The story is important to you. And that's kind of, I think anybody that's watching this will ever watch this. Like take that away from any time you see somebody like Dan on a show. If they talk about it from that perspective, like it's probably going to be pretty good.
Yeah.
Because the more you give a shit about a thing that you do, like, because it's obvious that, you know, like you said, Dan, you put part of yourself in every character. So that way you could have something that you latched onto for them empathetically, which will then give readers a reason to see every one of those characters as having worth and value and substance. And that's cool. Like, so, you know, kudos for all of that shit. Cause there are a lot of people, like I said, they try to do stuff like this and just can't. So, you know,
I'm 37. Like I've put other stuff out. But this is the biggest thing I've ever done. And I mean, yeah. There was parts where I'm like, well, like Lynch made his first film at 25, like and all these, like I kind of had these weird goals for myself. And then I was getting into my 30s. I'm like, well, am I getting too old? Is it too late? And I kind of just had to tell myself to like get over myself and just,
right.
It doesn't matter kind of. And that's another thing is Miyazaki made his first feature. He was 38, I think was when he made.
Wow, I didn't know that. Yeah.
He was like, I mean, he had done stuff in animation, but his first directorial film, he was in his late 30s.
Yeah. So how did you feel, did that pressure help push you through actually doing it and being like, okay, well, if I am going to do it, if I feel like I'm getting too old, then now is the time that I should do it because I may actually feel too old at some point and feel as though I am too old. So like now is the time to do it. If I'm going to do, like, did it like help you like buckle down on it at all?
Yeah, I think it really did. Cause I was probably 35 ish, right? Like hitting, I probably hit 35. So that's when you're like question, like that's one of the bigger milestones. So I probably was like, yeah, we got to do it. And like, cause I kind of self paid for like the editing and the art and stuff like that. And so I'm like, I mean, I was thinking about putting it towards a short film. And I got so fed up with, like, and because I'm like, okay, well then I have to call in like 80 favors to get a crew together. I got to do all this, like, and like a book you can just sit down and do, and like,
yeah.
You know, and films are so much harder to like kind of bring together. And and so actually, when I was writing the book, I made like a 1 minute short film just to kind of exercise those chops again. And so I was just like, during that time, I was just like, screw it. Like, I'm going to make a film with a shitty camera. I'm going to write a book. I'm just to finish it. Like, it was that period of my life where I'm like, I'm just going to complete things. I had a million unfinished things. And I'm like, I'm just going to, who cares if it's 1 minute long and the audio is bad? Like, just get it done.
Did you enjoy the process of writing the book?
Of writing the book, yeah.
Yeah.
I actually did. And you guys are creators as well. I think there's no better high than when you're really excited about something you created.
And yes.
There's no worse low too when you really hate what you're putting out. But
yeah.
But there is no greater high than when you really enjoy, like when you're like, oh my God, I can't believe I'm doing this. Like, I don't think I was capable.
Right. Yeah. And then it's done and you look at it and you're like, this is absolutely nothing like what I imagined, but it's exactly how I imagined it. You know, you get that point. You're like, that's it.
That's the most Chris thing I've ever heard.
That was true, though.
That's literally you the sit most back and you're like, Chris thing I've okay? ever heard. That's beautiful.
I accomplished everything I wanted. It in no way does it resemble what was in my head, but it did. It's the thing.
I'm gonna drug you and pay a tattoo artist to put that on your body.
Oh, please do. I love that. I just stand up on the show one day and it like peeks out.
Ow, why is my back hurt?
Oh, man. So we're getting toward the end of the show. We typically at this point in time do a picks and plugs section where we find something that we like that we recommend to the listeners at home to go check out. Dan, you're more than welcome to join. We'll put you up last if you can think of something you want to do.
Yeah, literally anything.
Yeah.
do you have a pick on deck? I got one if you don't.
Go ahead, man.
I watched Netflix put out this new series called Losers, and I started watching it. Really and have you watched it?
No, not yet. But Sarah's been chomping at the bit.
Yeah, it's pretty good. I watched the first two episodes, and basically, it's about great triumphant losses and how people have overcome them and managed to find success in different unexpected areas. It's centered around sports for the most part, but it's just all these great stories of people losing, you know, like the first one's about a boxer who was at the top of his game, accidentally became the heavyweight champion of the world and then got his shit wrecked, couldn't fight again. And now he's an actor and trains actors. And then the second one is about a low level club soccer team that was about to lose everything. And they managed to pull it together at the end of it. But, you know, they're still the losers because the only thing they saved was their right to exist. And it's pretty fantastic, and I can't wait to watch more of it.
Yeah, I'm interested in watching it. So my pick this week is something that I've gotten out of that I want to get back into, because one of my real estate clients is started talking to me about it because he plays a lot of disc golf. I miss playing disc golf. If you never played. It's really fun. It's not that difficult. It, you know, technical enough for you to feel like you're invested, not serious enough for you to get super butthurty. Go out with your friends, take a couple beers, bring your cigarettes, fucking throw shit at, throw plastic at metal.
Get some vitamin D.
Get some vitamin D, throw some plastic at some metal, do a little bit of walking. Like, you can go to really cool courses in the mountains and get like a nice hike in, and it's like, you work up a good sweat. It's good. Like, it's good.
So also, your pick is the concept of disc golf?
My pick is the concept of disc golf.
Okay.
But I have a plug real quick.
Okay.
Right before we get to you. I would like to say thank you to the guy that commented on one of our Instagram feeds or on one of our Instagram things that said, watching this show is like turning two TVs on full blast on shows you hate and one TV on static at full blast. First of all, thank you. That was fucking hilarious. And second of all, thank you for watching.
Oh my God, that's amazing.
I appreciate
that's going on my resume. Yeah,
that you took the time out of your day to post that, knowing that now you have fully engaged in a thing that you hated. So
you understand the show. Congratulations.
From me to you, thanks, biggest fan.
Oh God, that's fucking amazing.
It's awesome. I read it and I was like, they always tell you not to read the comments. This is gold. Oh my God, I love this. Like, I'm a fan. Dan,
you got picked.
What's your pick, man?
I am reading The Book of Disquiet right now by what's his name? Fernando Pessoa. I'm going to Lisbon in a couple months, so I was reading. I didn't know any famous authors from Lisbon, and I looked him up. And he wrote The Book of Disquiet, and it is one of the most depressing books that I've ever read, but it's about an office worker who wants to be a writer. And for some weird reason, it really made sense to me, and it's insanely depressing, but it's really beautifully, beautifully written.
Hell yeah. Dope. Where can people find out more about you, follow up, and get their hands on a copy of the book when it comes out?
Yeah, you could pre-order the book on Amazon if you look up Lingeria Book, L-I-N-G-E-R-I-A Book. I would recommend putting book or else lingerie is going to come up. It's a dollar. It's a dollar right now for the Kindle book. The hard copies, they don't do pre-orders for some reason on Amazon for hard copy. But the hard copy will be out April 1st. And you can find, if you look Lingeria Book, at Lingeria Book on Instagram, Twitter, or Facebook, you can find book links to the artwork and portions of the book I posted. So that's where you can. And you can find me at K0ZUH on Instagram and stuff. So
cool.
Still just came up with lingerie. I put Lingeria Book in here, and it's still just lingerie. It's books about lingerie.
Well, you're looking for that, too. So.
Yeah. It's gonna be a really good night.
Oh, man. So we're wrapping it up here. We're about to throw in the post show. Dan, you're welcome to hang out and chat with us for a few minutes after the show if you're into that. If not, you can totally go do the important
real
adult things you have
stuff.
To do. This has been Name Redacted Podcast. You can find it anywhere on the internet. Delicious podcasts are served every Sunday night right here at twitch.tv/AmericanFeral at 9 p.m. on Sundays Eastern time.
Sometimes.
That's backwards. I'm Chris Nielsen.
I am also Chris Nielsen.
Cool. Thanks for being an amazing guest. Go out and slap a couple butts.